Okay, so it's a pleasure to be here again. I've been in this ITP many times. The first time was in 82, and I'm very impressed to give the first talk after Herbert Kroner and Alan Heeger in this room, where they gave their press conference yesterday, so I'm very honored. So I want to thank Dan Hohn and also David Gross for giving me the opportunity to spend a sabbatical year here and participate the program next year in this biophysics, and Tony Z for inviting me to give a talk. So my interest in fact in protein folding and in this kind of biological problem started about 10 years ago. Because originally I was doing statistical physics of disordered systems and also of polymers, and it turns out that proteins have exactly some characters of both physics of polymers and of disordered systems. Now, since then, the field has become very important, in particular in biology, because of the sequencing of the genome. People are sequencing genes, and as we know, genes are coding proteins, and pretty soon all the genes, all the genome will be sequenced, but then it doesn't mean that you know what the proteins are doing. So, and the objects, the biological objects which really have a biological function are the protein. And before knowing what the protein do, some people think that that one intermediate step is to know what is their structure. So that's what I'm going to talk about today, about some simple models for protein folding. And the work I will be describing is a work which was done in collaboration in the last years with Thomas Garel from Saclay, Ludwig Leiber from ELF, and École de Physique Chimie Paris, and Seb Doniak from Stanford. So the outline of my talk is here. Is there a pointer somewhere? Yeah. Okay. So I will first, since Tony Z told me that people don't know what's a protein.
No, I don't know.
You don't know what's a protein, but you're made of it. And you eat it almost every, yeah.
Well, yesterday we learned that bladder was a polymer.
Right. So first I will, in a few words, I will explain the chemistry, structure, etc., all the basic things that a physicist has to know to talk about proteins. Then I will present some simplified models. So I will start with the simplest model possible, which is to discuss the theta collapse, which is due to the hydrophobic effect. Then I will show how to introduce the diversity in the sequence of the protein. This is a homopolymer model, so this will involve a sequence along the chain, and that's heteropolymer models. And then I will, if I have time, I will discuss models for hydrogen bonds. So the first part is in color. This is in black and white, and this is handwritten. Turns out it will be degrading as time goes on. So what is a protein? So protein belongs to a class of biological polymers. So biopolymers, there is essentially three kinds of biopolymers. There are proteins, nucleic acids. So nucleic acids are the DNAs and RNA, and polysaccharides, which are polysugars. And from a biological point of view, what characterizes them is they may have a catalytic activity in the case of enzymes. They may transport ions in the case of ion channels, or molecules like oxygen for hemoglobin. In muscles, they make up motor protein, which allow you to move. They make up the shell of viruses. All the viruses have a shell, outer shell, which is a protein, and they carry inside a piece of DNA or RNA. The famous prions are presumably misfolded proteins. And as we said, you have it in food, you eat it all the time. And most of the activity of the protein is related to the, so protein, as we will see, is a small polymer of size, typically of a few hundred monomers. that it has an active site which involves only a few monomers, 5 to 10, and the whole biological function of the protein is concentrated on this active site. So, as I write, it's a polymer which is made out of amino acids. There are 20 types of different amino acids, whose name is here. This is alanine, isoleucine, leucine, methionine, etc. They all have three-letter initials. They are all left-handed, and left-handed means that you have a C, a central carbon, which is called the alpha carbon, which is chiral, and left-handed, you have to look along this axis, and it turns in one sense, and it's just the contrary of right-handed, I think. And so this is the acid group, the organic carboxylic acid group, COOH, and this is the amine group, NHH. So all amino acids have this structure, except one, but for most purposes we'll look at this. And what the difference between all these amino acids is in the residue, which is here. And so it's like a 20-letter alphabet that you have. And you can classify them. So this is is it in French? Yes. So here is the list in French of all these amino acids. So you can recognize it's almost the same as in English, except here. Acid, you just remove the E. And you can classify them according to their polarity, hydrophilicity, hydrophobicity. And I will come back to that. But essentially, there are 8 amino acids which are hydrophobic and 12 which are hydrophilic. And among the hydrophilic, you have some hydrophilic which are neutral, and you have some hydrophilic which are charged, positive or negative. Then when you take two of these amino acids, what did I want to say? Yes, so this is the chemical formula. So in a typical protein, half of the amino acids are hydrophilic and half are hydrophobic. And typically these are the residues, the part which I denoted as R before, which is characteristic of the various amino acids. So this R, in the case of glycine, which is the simplest amino acid, is just a hydrogen atom, which is hydrophilic. The next simplest is alanine, which is hydrophobic, CH3, phenylalanine, which is also hydrophobic. And the most complicated one. So there is two amino acids which contain sulfur. One is cysteine. And the biggest one, which can make sulfur bridges, I will talk slightly about that. And the largest amino acid, the largest residue is tryptophan. So this is R, this residue, which has the nice property of being fluorescent. So in the experiment, it's very nice to monitor the fluorescence of the tryptophan. So then once you have these amino acids, you make a the cell usually makes it. And you have this polycondensation reaction. So this is amino acid number one. Here you had before COOH, and here you had NH2. So you take one OH from here, you won't take one hydrogen from here, you make a water molecule, and you make what's called a peptide bond. And then once you have done it, you can continue. And what you have, essentially at the end, you have a weakly branched polymer with a linear sequence. And here you have this alphabet R1, R2, R3, which specifies completely the protein sequence. So from a physical point of view, it's a very weakly branched polymer. And what is interesting is this peptide bond has this structure. So this C alpha is the carbon which carries the residue. And then this bond which is represented here is called the peptide bond, and it's a planar bond. And it's planar because the CO is hybridized with the CN, so this double bond in time becomes a double bond between C and N. It varies between CO and CN, and that's what makes it planar. And so in a protein, in a typical protein, there are several types of degrees of freedom. There are some degrees of freedom which are what I call hard degrees of freedom, and some which are soft. So the hard ones are those which are essentially frozen or which vary very little at room temperature. So for instance, covalent bonds don't vary very much. They are very rigid bonds, valence angle. These are the valence angle, the angles between two covalent bonds. The peptide bond is essentially frozen, and a dihedral, I'll come back to that. And on the other hand, there are soft degrees of freedom which can be very easily excited or which can fluctuate very easily at room temperature. And these soft degrees of freedom are essentially torsion angles. So this is a fixed plane, and this C alpha with its residue can rotate quite freely around this, and this plane can rotate freely around this one, and here if there is something, it can rotate essentially freely. Which means that the excitation energy of this motion is very small. Now, from a physical or statistical mechanical point of view, proteins exist under two different states, one which is called denatured, which has no biological activity, and one which is called native. The denatured state, or also called unfolded, can exist in some cases under two states, one which is a pure random coil, so it's like a random flight, so that the polymer is swollen or it's in a theta solvent in the solvent, which is water, or it can be globular, molten globule, but it doesn't have a specific shape, and therefore it has no biological activity. The native state of the protein, which is also called the folded state, corresponds to a unique compact structure, and this unique compact structure is always the same, so it's like a microstructure. If you unfold the protein and refold it, it will always go back into this unique state. And this is very unique in physics, I believe. If you think that the number of compact structures of the polymer, if you count the number of compact structures, it's exponentially large in the number of degrees of freedom. And therefore, if you take a typical protein of size 100 or 200, and you calculate what's this typical number, you see that the probability that the system will end up in one unique state at finite temperature is very small. So there is some kind of puzzle. Why does the system always find its way into a unique conformation at finite temperature? Which means, in some sense, that there is no conformational entropy in the folded state. There is, of course, vibrational or small motion phonon-like entropy, but no conformational entropy. Now, how does it look? Let me show you.
All the proteins in the body are folded, right?
Yes, otherwise they are not active.
And the food you eat, they are folded.
So when you cook it, yeah, you unfold it.
Unfold it, and
yes.
Your body folds it.
No, no, yeah. Your body digests it. So what you do is when you eat it, you break
it. Yeah.
You
break it up into
amino acids.
Which can be
yes. Because you cannot use directly a protein in your body because there are so many forms of proteins you couldn't recognize. So you digest them, which is a pity to, right? Such a complex structure.
To break it up.
Yes. So this is a computer. I'll show you computer-generated images of some protein. So this is the simplest one. It's BPTI. So of course, one of the challenges in proteins is to pronounce the names. So BPTI stands for bovine pancreatic trypsin inhibitor, and it's found in the pancreas of beef. And so this is the structure of BPTI in water. So it's a very compact object, as you can see, and one of the smallest protein that exists. It's I think 50. And something 53 or 56 amino acids. Well, you can guess if by looking at it you can find the active side. You're next after Alan Heger. And you will be worth a lot of money. This is a hemoglobin, which was the first protein which was resolved, which the structure of which was first resolved. The yellow are the sulfur atoms which make up these. So what's amazing is that this structure, you unfold it, so when you unfold it, it's like a, it's just like a line where everything is apart, and then you refold it and it will fall back exactly into this shape, up to less than an angstrom resolution. Here 150 something. 150. So this is a so-called space-killing view. And to show you a little bit more detail, I don't know if it's okay, the printer resolution on which I, the resolution of the printer on which I did this picture was not very good. But this is essentially the center of the various atoms making up the protein. And the outside, the unbound pieces are the water molecules, which are floating around because proteins, when they are resolved, they are crystallized in water, and people who do X-ray crystallography measure, of course, also the scattering from the nearby water molecule. But everything which is bound, which has the bonds in between, belongs to the protein. Okay. So some of the questions that one can ask is, what is the nature of this folding transition? Is it something like a crystallization, liquid to solid or gas to solid transition? Is it a glass-like transition, or is it not just a transition? It's purely dynamical. There is a very large basin of attraction where, starting from any initial condition, you fall into this basin of attraction. Some of the puzzles is, of course, how can one understand the uniqueness of the native state? Now, there is something else which appears in proteins, which is what's called a secondary structure, which I will discuss just after. So one of the questions is, how come there is so much secondary structure and that it's so stable? And also there are questions about dynamics. Is it exponential dynamics or stretched exponential or power law? What kind of dynamics is it? In time, as a function of time, if you look, for instance, the radius of gyration, how it, in the swollen phase, the radius of gyration is large and it goes to a much smaller value. So if you look how it decays as a function of time, or how the number of native bonds, which are the bonds in the final protein, varies as a function of time. Whether it's exponential, exponential, power law. So one of the things which was predicted by Pauling in, I think, 56 or 57, was the existence of secondary structures, and they came out to exist indeed. So the secondary structures are the following. There are essentially two types of secondary structure. There are one-dimensional secondary structure, which are called the alpha helices, and they are mainly right-handed. And they are right-handed because the amino acids are left-handed. And it goes like this. That's the backbone, so that's the main chain of the protein, which is going up. Now, if you remember on a previous slide, in the protein there is a CO and NH. And the CO and NH can make a bond. So this would be, for instance, CO and here NH. And then there is a, what chemists call hydrogen bond, which can take place between these two guys. And it's a binding bond. And when you have such a structure, one-dimensional structure, you can put a lot of hydrogen bonds. And this, of course, will stabilize this structure and make it quite stable. So typically, there is 3.6 amino acids per turn. And typically, a helix in a protein has 5 to 7 turns. The other structure which appears in proteins, the other type of secondary structure, is the beta sheet. So it's two-dimensional, and the backbone makes such a shape, and then the hydrogen bonds are like this between the various strands of the beta sheet. So, for instance, if you remember this hemoglobin, Yes, the beta sheet is essentially in a single plane, although it might be distorted. So you certainly recognize the hemoglobin, which is upside down, I guess. And that's the whole atom structure. And it turns out that if you look only at the backbone, and if you're really good, you'll see this. And this is the helical structure.
I'm confused about the previous.
You don't recognize it.
Unfolded or
no, it is folded. It's perfectly.
What is the space between all these?
Oh, it's the space is because this is in the pictures in the space filling. Yes.
Right?
So it's because the radius here one uses what's called the van der Waals radii of the atoms, which are essentially the scattering radii of the atoms. So just the same picture with smaller, yeah. Yes. Yes, but in a protein there is no empty space inside. When you put in the van der Waals radii, there is no water, there is no vacuum, nothing. It's completely space filled. And this is just to illustrate to see a little bit better, but. And I don't know if one can. Maybe. Okay, with a little imagination, maybe we can. No, not this. Maybe. Okay, I should have prepared. Okay, next time I give this talk, I will prepare. Let me show you another protein, the name of which is absolutely impossible. It's a venom of an insect. It's not deadly, but it's supposed to be unpleasant. And you see a whole bunch of alpha helices running over. And these are beta sheets going up and down. And this is the whole protein. No, in general, there are no chemical. No chemical bonds. Except there is the hydrophobic effect, which I will discuss, which is that there is water, all this is in water, so there is a pressure for the system to keep together to avoid the presence of water in the inside of the protein. So how do people So there are several levels of structure. So one thing is called the primary structure is the chemical structure, the chemical formula, or the chemical sequence of amino acids. Then the secondary structure is the short-range structure that I showed you before, and the tertiary structure is the 3D structure of the folded protein, and it's essentially the packing of all the secondary structures. So it's the what you see on an X-ray scattering. Now, how can one see the folding transition? The folding transition can be seen by measuring the radius of gyration of the protein, and this can be done by X-rays, neutron scattering, or now there are all kinds of fluorescence experiments which allow to measure the radius of gyration as a function of time. And of course, when the protein is unfolded, it's a swollen chain, so it's big, and when it's folded, it's much smaller, so you can do it like this. When the protein is unfolded, it has no biological activity. When it's folded, it has biological activity. So by looking at the recovering of the biological activity, you can see the folding transition. NMR allows to look for nearby atoms in the protein. So some people look at the folding transition using NMR. And circular dichroism is a method where you probe essentially the optical activity of the protein due to the presence of these secondary structures, which are of course optically active. One of the results is that the renaturation or the folding time of a protein varies between milliseconds to seconds. So that's the order of magnitude. It's a quite large time scale, especially when we will see given the size of the object, which are very small, and the microscopic time scales, which are 10 to the minus 15 seconds and so on. So how can one see the 3D structure? The 3D structure, there are essentially two methods. Initially, it was the only method was X-ray crystallography. So what you do is you make a crystal of your protein and then you send X-ray on it and you look at the diffraction pattern. And of course, that's a very nice way to do it, but there is no systematic way to make crystals, and there are very few proteins of which you can make a crystal and that you can crystallize. A new method which has emerged since about 10 or 15 years is NMR-NOE, where essentially what you do is you measure nearby pairs of hydrogen atoms, and from the constraints of knowing which hydrogen atoms are nearby, you can reconstruct sometimes the structure. It's not always the case, but sometimes it works. So what do chemists and biochemists do for a living? So they search, they look for effective atom-atom interactions. So it's so-called all-atom models. And what they do is they generate semi-empirical Hamiltonians, which are supposed to describe the interaction of the various atoms which make up the protein. And then once they have this semi-empirical Hamiltonian, they can do molecular dynamics, Monte Carlo, or Langevin, whatever you want. So the first question to discuss is what interactions are present in the protein. So there are essentially two types of interactions. There are bonded interactions, which are essentially the covalent bond, which make up the backbone of the protein. So this is a covalent bond, this is a covalent bond. And among the covalent bond, there is one which is a little specific, which is the sulfur bridge, which is a covalent bond between two amino acids of the protein, which are not close on the chain, but which can be far apart. Now, the important interactions in the folding process, as we will see, are the non-bonded interactions. And the non-bonded interactions, essentially, there are two. There is the Coulomb interaction, and the Coulomb interaction, it's a chemical description of the fact that there are partial charges on the various atoms. So if one atom is slightly electropositive, it will carry a small partial charge, and so on. And so there is chemists assign a partial charge to all these atoms, and these partial charges interact through a Coulomb interaction. Then there is a van der Waals type of interaction between the atom, which is modeling the steric repulsion and the fact that you cannot put two atoms too close together. There is a kind of hardcore repulsion. And there is another interaction which I discussed before, which is the hydrogen bond, which can be either between two parts of the molecule of the protein or between the molecule, the protein, and the solvent. And in most modern what people call force fields, which are these in most modern Hamiltonian empirical Hamiltonian, these hydrogen bonds are not put in by hand, they're generated by Coulomb interaction and van der Waals interaction. So when you have a protein in water, certain residues are hydrophilic, some are hydrophobic, and it's believed that the transition, the collapse transition and the folding transition is induced by this hydrophobic interaction, namely that the hydrophobic residues want to hide inside the protein and in order to avoid the contact with water. So the energy scales which are involved. Sorry?
Membrane
proteins. Not really, because membrane protein have the inner part of membrane proteins are very hydrophobic, so they get stuck in the membrane. Frightening. And the hydrophilic part is in water. Sorry?
They won't collapse.
They won't collapse? No, they are folded. Well, usually the proteins which are in membranes are... So there are very few proteins which are known, which have been crystallized in membrane. The typical one is bacteriorhodopsin, which is a bunch of alpha helices which go across the membranes, and I think there is five or seven bunch of helical pieces like this, and they're stuck together in the membrane. It's bacteriorhodopsin. All the proteins which have been, all the membrane, there are very, very few, I think less than 10 membrane proteins which have been folded. Okay, the dielectric constant is a subject of big fights between chemists. So they use a distance-dependent, some use a distance-dependent dielectric constant. Some use so depending whether if you are inside the protein, then there is no water, so you are supposed to use the dielectric constant of the vacuum. If you are at this, if you are in water, you're supposed to take 80, and usually many people use 4 or 5 as an average constant. Sorry? No, it depends. All this is very empirical. I'm not going to discuss this force field, so I don't want to go too much into details. I have no particular feelings about this dielectric constant. Okay. So the typical scale, the energies are measured in chemistry in kilocalorie per mole or in kilojoule per mole. So let's say in kilocalorie per mole, and that's 300K, room temperature is 0.6 kilocal per mole.
Can you translate the mole into bond?
No, I can't. I'm not a real chemist. No, but I know that half a kilocalorie per mole. Well, actually, the question is here. It's just here. Just read. One covalent bond is 550 to 150 kilocalorie per mole. So it's huge compared to that, which means that it's a frozen bond. It's not going to be thermally excited at this temperature, so you can forget about these bonds, you take them frozen. Same for the sulfur bridges. Now the only interactions which are going to be relevant at room temperature are these ones. So there is the hydrogen bond, and that's effectively an effect of dielectric constant. They are much stronger, of course, in a nonpolar solvent because the dielectric constant is smaller. But in water, it's 1 to 2 kilocalorie per mole. Van der Waals is 1 to 2 kilocalorie per mole, and Coulomb also. So the only really relevant interactions which are going to make up the shape and the structure of the protein are these three ones. And the other ones are frozen, and they are just like constraints. And the denaturation temperature, or the folding temperature, is typically higher, a little bit higher than room temperature. It's typically 1 kilocalorie per mole. So from a physical point of view, you have a chemical sequence which is frozen, and the folding is driven by these three interactions, which are the non-covalent or non-bonded interactions. And this is a typical parametrization of the electric of the force field which I showed you, which I discussed before. So this is the covalent bond energy, where B is the distance and this is a reference energy. This describes the vibration of this valence angle. These are the torsional energies. These are improper dihedral. So this is van der Waals type of interaction. It's a 612 Lennard-Jones potential. And this is Coulomb with partial charges, where epsilon is the dielectric constant, and 332 is a magic number when you are dealing with kilocalorie per mole. So it's, what is it? It's, it's the Boltzmann factor, everything in kilocal per mole. And then what you can do is just solve the Newton or Langevin equation of this type with a noise which satisfies the fluctuation dissipation theorem. And then if you wait long, if you solve these equations long enough, then the probability distribution for the coordinates when time goes to infinity, they will just sample the Boltzmann distribution, provided you wait long enough and you don't have any problem with discretization. Now the difficulty comes at this stage. The discretization time is fixed essentially by the fastest degrees of freedom which are present in the system, and typically the delta t to discretize the Langevin or Newton or whichever equation is between 10 to the minus 15 and 10 to the minus 13 seconds, which is the time of the vibration of covalent bond or valence bond, which is also, so 10 to the minus 13 is also the time of rotation of the methyl group. So 10 to the minus 13 to 10 to the minus 12 is really the lowest bound that one can use for the discretization. The number of degrees of freedom for the system, as I said, if you have a protein which has about 100 amino acids, it will have, each amino acid has on the average 10 atoms, so you have 1,000 particles to evolve, and each one has three coordinates, so typically you're dealing with more than 1,000 degrees of freedom. And you need to simulate also the water molecule, because everything is in water. And the largest time which have been simulated up to now go to about 10 to the minus 8 seconds for small proteins. And this time is of course much smaller than the folding time, which is of the order of 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 2 seconds. Actually, at this time scale, nothing happens. There is no sign, no visible sign of any activity. If you start from an unfolded state and let it fold, you don't see any secondary structure appearing or anything. Nothing happens, essentially. And one of the reasons which is invoked is that the number of compact structures of, as I said, of a compact chain is exponentially large. So all these structures, which makes that you have a phase space which has a shape, a very rugged shape. So I don't write the coordinates, of course. And here you have one state which is the so-called native state, which has a lower free energy than all the other states. And of course, if you start your dynamics from any state, you will get trapped in one of the local minima, and it will take forever to get out of it. And that's why these numerical simulations take so much time and are so complicated to do. So now what I will do is I will discuss some very simplified models. So this, the chemist's approach is very detailed. It takes all the degrees of freedom in quite a lot of detail. So I will try to present simpler approach which simplifies and which tries to get the essential of the model. So the simplest thing one can think is that you have a polymer, and when you cool it down, it collapses, and that's the folding transition. So on the average, you have the hydrophobic residues which want to make a hydrophobic core to be protected from water and surrounded by hydrophilic residues. And on the average, in a protein, one has a one-half hydrophilic, one-half hydrophobic residue. So the simplest model that one can think of is a model where you take, it's a homopolymer model, where you take all residues to be identical and to be hydrophobic on the average. So this is the model which I will discuss very briefly, because it's a very well-known model. So you represent each amino acid, you forget the microscopic structure of each amino acid. It's really a statistical mechanical model where each segment represents an amino acid, and you assume that all residues are identical and hydrophobic on the average. So we know that indeed water induces an effective attractive interaction between hydrophobic monomers. If you have two molecules which are hydrophobic, They don't like to be surrounded by water, so if they come close together, the surface accessible to water is smaller than the sum of the surfaces when they are both in contact with water, and therefore there is an effective attractive interaction induced by the solvent. And this model of a polymer in a bad solvent was discussed by Flory in the 50s, I think. So for instance, if you take such an interaction to model the hydrophobic interaction, the hydrophobic attraction between the monomers. So the monomers like to attract up to a certain distance, and of course they cannot penetrate beyond because there is some hardcore repulsion. The partition function of the system can be simply written like this. And this model has been studied by Flory and by many other people since then. And the results of this model are the following. There is, of course, a competition. The entropy when the chain is swollen is much larger than when the chain is compact. But on the other hand, when the chain is compact, the attractive energy is much larger. And as a result, there is a phase transition as temperature varies, which is called the theta point. And the phase diagram can be described easily in the following way. At high temperature, the system is in a swollen phase, so it's an entropy-dominated phase. The radius of gyration scales as n number of monomers to a power nu, where nu is a universal exponent, and nu is approximately 3 feet. Below this critical temperature theta, the system collapses into a collapsed phase, which is a compact globular phase, with a radius of gyration which scales also like n to the nu, but with another exponent nu, which is 1/3. And nu equals 1/3 is just the standard exponent for a collapsed phase. And in between, there is a theta point at theta temperature, which is in 3D, turns out that the theta point at exactly this temperature, the chain is essentially Brownian, with a radius of gyration which scales like the square root of n, up to logarithmic corrections. So this type of transition is a second order tricritical point. And now I want to discuss why this is, of course, not a good description of the folding transition, why it cannot describe this. The first reason is that in the collapse phase, in the low temperature phase, which is collapsed, the system has a finite entropy, and this of course is not possible because we saw that in the folded state a protein is in a unique state, so one expects to have a very small or zero entropy. In fact, in the swollen phase, the number of configuration of the chain scales as a certain number gs to the power n times n to the gamma minus 1, but this gn, so there is in the swollen phase you have an exponentially large number of configurations, where this GS, for instance, on a 3D cubic lattice is 4.2. In the collapse phase, it's the same shape, the same kind of functional form, but with a G, which is smaller. So there has been, of course, there are much less configurations of the chain in the collapse phase than in the swollen phase, but still 2.2 to the N is a very large number. So there is a lot of entropy, and so that is not, of course, acceptable. The second thing is, of course, that in this model there is no secondary structures. There was nothing to make secondary structures to start with. So, of course, that's not correct. And the third point is that the theta transition is second order. So it's difficult to say what is the order of a transition for such a small system like a protein, but people have a tendency to believe that protein folding is really a first order kind of transition. And this is more or less in agreement with the fact that when you have a first order transition, you have a latent heat, and therefore you have a strong decrease of entropy. So if you go from a swollen phase which has a large entropy to a phase which has no entropy, you expect it to be rather first order. Okay, so I want to discuss now how one can improve on this model, at least a little bit. And the thing which is of course missing in this model is the sequence diversity. So each amino acid, there are 20 types of different amino acids, so one should have in principle 20 types of different monomers in the system. And the model that I proposed had only one type, all hydrophobic. Now, of course, it's very difficult to make simple models for such complicated systems. So one has to make some randomness kind of assumptions to describe these systems. So there is no known specific arrangement of amino acids. If I present any sequence of amino acids which has the right starting residues and the right ending residues, and I present it to anybody, usually you cannot say whether it's a real protein, whether it's a good, not good protein. So the simplest model that one can think about is to assume that the sequence of amino acids is random. And of course, it's a random quenched sequence because it doesn't rearrange in time. It's a quenched random heteropolymer model. So of course, a real protein is not a random sequence. It has been selected by evolution, and it has been selected through millions or billions of years. But too difficult to study. So if
people look for correlations, but they
yes. So you can find correlations in DNA, but usually it's correlations in the function of the different pieces of DNA. But in proteins, there is essentially no. First of all, it's a small object, right? It's typical size is 100 to few hundred. So looking at the correlation, yes. Okay, so people are discussing that, and the problem is that if you make a synthetic sequence, usually you cannot crystallize it, and so you don't know what is the three-dimensional structure. But most people think that if you take a completely random sequence without any bias in the sequence, it will essentially it will not fold. But it's a belief. A pure belief. If they told you it does fold, it will. There is no real argument about that. There are some numerical simulations, which I will say a few words about that. But there is no strong argument, let's say, to. No, okay. The statistical mechanics approach will tell you, essentially. So if you do a quenched average, it will tell you what is the behavior of a typical random sequence, right? And we will see that the behavior of a typical random sequence is not so bad if the model, in certain cases, that it has some properties at least of proteins. So the idea is to do a quenched average over all possible sequences and try to calculate what's going on. So the partition function of these models generically has this form. That's a discrete version. One can usually to study it, simpler to study continuous version. And so this is the elastic energy of the chain, or the chain constraint, if you want. This is a two-body interaction, and this is a three-body interaction, which is there just to avoid the collapse of the chain to a single point. So one assumes in these simplified models that there is only contact interaction, so delta function interaction, that the three-body repulsion is non-random. This term, which is here, is just amino acid independent, and it's there just to avoid collapse. So it's a three-body term with a sequence independent. It's a constant three-body term to avoid collapse. And now the sequence diversity that you have in the chain is represented through this two-body interaction. So this V is taken to be a delta function, so it's a contact interaction with a Jij, Gij, sorry, and Gij is a set of random quenched variables. Okay, so it depends on the model, but in principle it's on both sides, because if it's positive, then it's a repulsive interaction. If it's negative, it's attractive interaction. And you want, for instance, if you take two hydrophobic residues, they have a tendency to attract. If you have two hydrophilic residues, they will repel. So indeed, you want this G to be able to have a positive and negative sign. So the model to study is something like this. With a delta, so this is a Gij, delta of Rij, and this is a constant term. So it's essentially a quenched random heteropolymer model. So in order to do the quenched average, one uses the standard replica trick. And the replica trick is just a way to calculate the average of log z. The free energy is log z, so you have to calculate the free energy average. And the average of log z, what you do is you calculate the average of z to the n for any n, take a derivative with respect to n, and then you do the analytic continuation at n equals 0. And that's the standard replica trick. And the first model that I want to discuss in the last few minutes is the hydrophilic hydrophobic model. So now all the various models that one can define will depend on the distribution of probabilities, or the kind of Gij that one uses. So one model which is the simplest generalization of this hydrophobic model that I described before is to assume that certain amino acids are hydrophobic, I denote them by H, and others are hydrophilic, and I describe them by P, and P for polar. So in the presence of water, the polar amino acids want to be surrounded by water, so they will be outside, and the hydrophobic ones will go inside. And you expect some kind of micellar structure with a hydrophobic core and a hydrophilic. So the interaction Vij is taken of this form. It's additive lambda I plus lambda j, where the lambda I, if lambda I is positive, it describes a hydrophilic amino acid. Lambda I negative describes a hydrophobic amino acid. So that if you look at the interaction of two polar residues or hydrophilic, it's lambda I plus lambda j will be positive, so it's repulsive. If the two are hydrophobic, they are both negative, so it gives an attractive interaction. And the hydrophilic-hydrophobic interaction depends on the sum of the lambda I and lambda j. And the last thing is that you take the lambda I's to be Gaussian random independent variables with an average lambda zero, which is the average hydrophilicity or hydrophobicity of the chain, and lambda is the width of the distribution of hydrophilic or hydrophobic charges. Then one can perform the quenched average. That's easy. And then one has to do some approximations to solve the model. So without entering into details or technicalities, the kind of approximations which are performed is mean field theory on the replicated Hamiltonian, which is fairly standard. And another approximation which is fairly standard in polymer theory is to use the ground state dominance, which is an approximation which is valid in the thermodynamic limit when for very long chains. So the result of this model is that for any average hydrophobicity, the system will collapse at low enough temperature. So there is always a collapse transition, but there is no replica symmetry breaking in this model. That's a technical way to say that there is no freezing or no glass transition in this model. So So it's a quite ordinary phase transition. And the phase diagram is the following, except that there are two very distinct behaviors which can occur. If on the average the system is strongly hydrophobic, so there is some critical lambda C negative. So if lambda zero, the average hydrophobicity of the system, is negative enough, the system has a second order collapse transition, which is driven by this negative average value. And this this collapse is very similar to an ordinary theta point. So essentially, since the system is on the average very hydrophobic, what happens is that the whole system collapses, and you'll have some of the residues of the hydrophilic residues will be inside, some will be outside, and on the majority, the system will try to put most of the hydrophilic residues outside, but you make a big globule, and it's a second order transition with a unique globule.
So in the extreme limit, this is kind of
this approaches this exactly. Now in the case where lambda zero is small or is essentially weakly negative or zero or positive even, the transition is a collapse transition. The collapse transition is first order and it's induced by fluctuation of the three body term. So this is a little technical, and you can see that when you do the average over replicas. But essentially the physical picture is slightly different. It's not an ordinary theta point. It's not also a glass transition. The system breaks into small structures like this, which makes it makes small cores, hydrophobic cores, surrounds them by hydrophilic residues, and repeats this for the system. Now, the size of these little structures is very difficult to calculate from the model, but one can easily imagine that it can be of the order, typically it could certainly be of the order of 100. And what it tells you is that if the system becomes large enough, it should break into multi-domain. And indeed, large proteins that exist in nature are multi-domain. And that's because it's very difficult for a large protein to accommodate all the hydrophilic and hydrophobic residues into a unique globule. It's easier to condense each of the globules separately and surround it by hydrophilic residues and repeat the this. Sorry? No, you can show that. Well, you can show that it's okay. First of all, there were numerical simulations for that. The structure of the when you do the calculation when you do the analytic calculation, you see, of course, that you have a first order transition in one case, you have a second order transition in the other case. Now, the fact that you have exactly this kind of structure, you can see a sign of it is that if you put in the system, if you try a modulated structure instead of a uniform structure for your wave function, you will see that in this case there appears a kind of modulation with a typical scale, and that gives the scale of the various of the hydrophobic core and of the hydrophilic. So there are, but obviously there is a difference between the two, and when you do a Monte Carlo simulation, you really see this structure appear. I mean, this is of course a drawing. If you're on the lattice, it doesn't really look like this, but you can see very separate hydrophobic cores, which the transition in that case is first order, and you have small collection of small objects which are condensing simultaneously. As a result, there is metastability and retardation effects, which of course would have important dynamical consequences. And since it's first order, there is a latent heat and strong entropy reduction. However, this system still has a quite large conformation of entropy at low temperature, and therefore one has to improve still this model if one wants to describe the uniqueness of the of this.
What do you mean by retardation? That there's no time in the model.
No. I just say that's no. Whenever you have a first order transition, you have barriers and you have nucleation effects. It's a general statement. Yes. Yes. And then I know that when I look at the system close to a first order transition, I will have an unusual dynamical behavior. So another extreme model, and I will end on this, is the random bond model. So the random bond model is really like the spin glass model in ordinary spin glass theory. As we saw before, probably one of the reasons the model doesn't work very well is that there is the characterizes each amino acid by a single number, which is its hydrophilicity or hydrophobicity degree. And this is certainly not enough. You need something a little richer. So another extreme model is to take still the same functional form, but now with the Gij, which are independent random variables. So distributed in a Gaussian way with the average G0 and with a variance G. And this is very much like the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model in spin glass theory. And again, one can perform a quenched average over the variable Gij. And if one does that, there are two natural order parameters which appear in the theory. One is a density-like order parameter, and the other one is an overlap type of order parameter. And in fact, the partition, the replicated and average partition function can be written as a functional integral over these order parameters of a certain effective free energy. And the two other parameters are here, so this is really like a density, as I said, and this is an overlap. And then one does mean field theory, which means that you minimize F with respect to rho and Q. And again, the phase diagram is quite simple to obtain. At high temperature, the solution of this is a minimization equation, give rho alpha equals 0 and Q equals 0. So rho equals 0 means that you're in a coil state with zero density, and Q equals zero means that there is no freezing of the system. So at high temperature, the system is in a coil phase. When you decrease the temperature, there is a theta temperature which appears, and the system goes into a collapse of globular phase, which is characterized by the density or the parameter, which is non-zero, but this overlap order parameter, which is still zero. So it's not a frozen phase, and therefore it's a phase with a large entropy. It's like a liquid kind of, a collapsed liquid phase. And so this is an intermediate denatured compact phase between the theta temperature and another temperature, which is here. And this transition is second order. And then there is a new temperature, which is Tf, which is kind of freezing temperature. And below this temperature, the two other parameters are non-zero, both the density, which means that the phase is compact, and the overlap order parameter, which means that the system is in a frozen phase. As a result, in this phase, the system is very much like a random energy model. And in this phase, the system has a non-extensive entropy. It has essentially the extensive part of the entropy is zero. And this frozen phase is very similar to the low temperature phase of thin glasses. It has it breaks the replica symmetry. And as a consequence, there are a very small number of dominant states which dominate the thermodynamics of the system at low temperature. And it's tempting to identify these dominant states at low temperature with the native states of the protein. So this model has been studied on a lattice, and there has been hundreds of papers on this 3 by 3 by 3 cube, because if you look at this model on a 3 by 3 by 3 cube, you can enumerate exactly all the walks on this cube, and simulations have been done on larger lattices. And then people have been asking a question about the dynamics of this kind of model. And what people find, and this is a little bit to answer your question, that if you take any random, completely random sequence, they reach the ground. So on this 3x3x3 lattice, of course, you can, if you can enumerate exactly all conformations, you know what is the ground state of the system. So you know exactly the ground state, and you can look, calculate, or measure how long it takes in a Monte Carlo or molecular dynamic time, starting from a random state, to fold into the final state. And what people seem to find is that if you start from a generic random sequence, it takes much, much longer to reach the ground state than if you start from a specifically designed sequence. So there are some specifically designed sequences that you can construct on this cube, which will fold extremely fast. And if you take any other sequence, it will fold in a much longer time. And therefore, these people say that there has been an evolutionary selection of this sequence due to the fact that if they fold and if they are useful, then they will reproduce and all the others will just disappear. So this is the evolutionary pressure on the sequences in terms of the folding time. So these models, yes? Sorry? It's not folded. That's what they. So it's sorry. Yes, but it's you can show that the folding time is related to the first passage time. So if you start from a random configuration, you calculate the average time, the average first passage time, which is the average time it will take you to fold exactly into the native state. And you do an average over that, and that's the so-called folding time. So it's not just one run, you have to make many runs to calculate this folding time. Well, in this there is no, in this kind of model, there is no, that's interesting. Sorry? Yes. In this model, I'm not sure. Well, you have to do sequence design to. I'm not sure that there is. But that's a very interesting. Yeah. Okay. That would be. Yeah. I understand. Yeah. No, I don't know. So in any case, this model is also very crude because it doesn't contain a sequence. It's just random JIJ. So it's not really a sequence. It doesn't treat the sequence properly, and it doesn't include the secondary structures. So I gave about 70% of my talk, and I think I have abused your patience enough. So I will stop here, and I will continue this talk, I think, next semester during the the next workshop, right?
Thank you very much. Please feel free to ask questions.
You know, people have that method where they take a random sequence and let it fold.
Yeah.
And then they what? Yeah. Then they rearrange the sequence to minimize the grants to one or two of that. Then unfold it and let it fold, and it folds much faster.
To the same state?
To the same
state. Okay, so this I don't know.
And actually, the most amazing thing of all is that just by minimizing the ground state energy under permutation of the sequence, you do it to just minimize the ground state energy, and that's enough to make a fast fold.
Question?
Oh, yes, sure. I think it's not exactly the same question he's asking.
So you discussed the
cryptography
of native states.
Yes.
What's known about the dynamics before then the business comes apart?
Crystallizes or falls apart? Or?
Well, I think it's the low energy excitation of that entity.
Okay, of the protein.
Yes.
Okay. So there is a spectrum, of course, of small vibrations which exist, and actually what people do is they do normal mode analysis around, so they take the crystal.
Well, I guess I'm going to ask a specific question. You presented it as if there was no clue whatsoever Yeah, there's many possible configurations that always choose the same one.
Yes.
And the puzzle is, you know, what's the path by which it likes to find that state? My question is, are there any clues from low energy dynamics?
I see. Okay, so first of all, there is evidence that there is not a unique pathway, that there are many. And that was one of the big surprises to the chemists, because chemists are not used to, chemists are used when you have a chemical reaction that there is a unique pathway. You have some intermediates in the middle. If you remember your high school chemistry, you start from A, you go to B, and you have a certain number of intermediates, and you always have your reaction through these intermediates. In protein folding, apparently it's not at all like this. There are some protein folding which fold with a fixed pathway and with fixed intermediates, but most of them don't. Most of them just fold, you can through many different routes.
But the last few steps you need?
Yes, probably this one. I mean, once you get in the right basin of attraction, of course, it should be okay. But there is no unique pathway in principle. Oh yeah, but that's the Rayleigh instability.
Okay,
yeah.
In
this case, the Rayleigh instability is different, right? It's a balance between the bulk energy and the surface energy. Here you have clusters you have a sequence of hydrophilic and hydrophobic, and you have a lot of hydrophilic, let's say half and half hydrophilic, hydrophobic. So you cannot make a big, what you can do is you can bunch together certain number of hydrophobic, put them like this, but then because it's a chain, the hydrophilic will come and they will. So if you want to have a sequence which is favorably in contact with water for the hydrophilic, if you don't want to bury too many hydrophilic inside, you have to break it up into small pieces. And this effect is important if you have enough hydrophilic in your sequence. So that's why you have this micelization effect.
Other questions? Well, let's thank the speaker again.